This is Sam Tatum, author of Evolutionary Ideas, Unlocking Ancient Innovation to Solve Tomorrow's Challenges, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a free copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Sam Tatum to talk about his book, Evolutionary Ideas, Unlocking Ancient Innovation to Solve Tomorrow's Challenges, published by Harriman House. Sam Tatum is Global Head of Behavioral Science at Ogilvy. His passion is understanding human behavior, and his experience comes from organizational, industrial psychology, and advertising strategy. From New York to Nairobi, Sam has led behavior change projects across virtually every category and continent. Today, he leads a global team of talented psychologists and behavioral economists to develop interventions and shape the communications of some of the world's most influential brands and organizations. And, interesting fact, a first draft of this book to his publisher contained a typo in the book's title. Sam, congratulations on Evolutionary Ideas and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks so much, Douglas. Off to a rough start there, but we got there in the end.
Yes. Well, I would have never known. I didn't see any typos. And when you're the host of the Marketing Book Podcast and you get to read all these books, you do notice a few typos, and that's okay. That's okay. So you are in the Sydney, Australia area. And right. As we speak, and I'm on the East Coast of the United States, so as is always the case, when I'm interviewing an author in Australia, we have to do it at a different time. So as we record this, it's 6 p.m. on Thursday evening here on the East Coast, and it's 8 a.m. Friday morning there in Sydney, Australia. And over the years, I've marveled at the fact that I'm talking to someone from the future. But I've given up asking, because naturally I'd say, "Oh, well, Sam, tell me what's going to happen. What's the future contain?" But I never got the right answer. And just so everybody knows why I'm not going to ask this question anymore, this is the answer I was always looking for.
Well, everyone has a flying car. Entire meals come in pill form, and the Earth is ruled by damn dirty apes.
That's the future I want to know about.
Sounds like Australia already.
Yeah. Well, that's Austin Powers. So, I had him come into the studio here and record it. But no, I'm just kidding. Now, I noticed your book was endorsed by, a number of heavy hitters. Come on. But includes guy I've interviewed twice, Nir Eyal. Mm. Oh, my goodness. His books have actually caused me to change. In other words, he wrote, his first book was Hooked, about how to build addictive products, which the joke is that every executive in Silicon Valley has a copy of his book on the shelf, but he'll say, yeah, but they already know how to do that. And then his other book, I guess maybe written out of guilt, was called Indistractable.
Indistractable.
Just amazing. And thanks to Nir, I initially took the social media apps off my phones. And in the meantime, I've ultimately just deactivated my Facebook account. It's very interesting. And then you have the foreword to the book by Rory Sutherland, who I've had the honor of interviewing. His book Alchemy, and reading his book was an adventure, and interviewing him was an adventure. I think that's the interview where I spoke the least, because he just runs with it, and it was a great interview. And his book has been mentioned by a lot of listeners, but also authors. They've talked about how much they liked his book, and you've been really influenced by him, and you both work
Absolutely.
For Ogilvy.
Yeah, I've been fortunate to work with Rory for many years, and he's a huge influence on this book and my thinking and the category that we work within. So I was sort of really touched with the foreword that he wrote, and I mean, we're close friends and colleagues, but a wonderful influence on me in the book. And similarly, Nir. I remember writing to Nir. I met him in London a couple of years ago, but I remember years ago starting out in advertising, sitting in, I was on a work trip to Melbourne, sitting in a cafe just paging through Hooked. And if we look at both Hooked and Indistractable, sort of deconstructing two ways of creating better habits and starting to change distractions, and very much an architectural perspective, just shows how we can do both if we do it on purpose and understand what are the levers that we're trying to pull here. So two big influences on me, certainly.
Yes. And I noticed, so you work for Ogilvy. And
that's right.
I'm an alumnus of J. Walter Thompson, New York. So I appreciate you quoting more than once James Webb Young, the legendary 20th century ad man who worked for J. Walter Thompson and wrote a book, I think he first published it in 1940, called A Technique for Producing Ideas, that I'm sure you're really familiar with. In fact, that may have been where you got the quotes from.
Certainly, and when you look at, I mean, the timeless quotes, I think, and that's part of the theme of the book. Certainly, when it comes to the creation of ideas, a big part of evolutionary ideas is looking at sort of a systematic approach to creativity. And sometimes you might imagine in the advertising field or creative industry that sort of we romanticize off the wall thinking and sort of magicians in a dark garage that come up with a sort of a light bulb moment. And so thinking about ideas of more like construction than creation could be seen as a deviation. And James Webb Young talks about the creation of ideas just like the creation of automobiles, that we can think about it in a structured approach. So wonderful to be able to sort of lean on that to help to draft my argument too.
Yes, I remember it. J. Walter, the expression the really good creatives had was tight briefs liberate.
That's right.
So, and you talk about that a good bit there. And it also ties in with three really phenomenal books I've had on the show over the years about creativity. All of them adhere to that as well. It's not lightning in a bottle. It's following a structured system.
Yes.
So I want to quote from a couple sections. I couldn't resist. I need to quote from this one part in Rory's forward. He just doesn't disappoint. So, but there's one part where he says, the role of marketing and advertising, which is also a game of experimentation, variation, and selection, is an essential and often ignored handmaiden to innovation. Successes in marketing seem obvious in retrospect, but are rarely obvious at the time. It is for this reason that we not only need to experiment more, but also benefit from evolutionary pattern recognition in deciding what to test. Evolution does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And then I want to jump over to another page from your prologue, which is page XX. You didn't know I spoke Roman, did you, Sam?
Yeah.
There's one section where you write, I decided to write this book to illuminate the vast opportunities the fields of behavioral science and evolutionary psychology offer contemporary innovation. Through this book, my ambition is to help us spend less time developing expensive and high-risk solutions and more time embracing and imaginatively executing psychological solutions that have been road-tested over time. I will share a process that can be learned, yet still applied magically. You are about to embark on a journey to identify patterns of evolved psychological solutions. You will see that once you know what you're looking for, these solutions can be consciously redeployed to solve some of the most important challenges you face. Through them, you will find a faster, more efficient, and more effective approach to innovate creatively. And then finally, I want to jump over to the next page where you write, this book is for problem solvers. While I work in the creative field, it's not just a book for advertisers or marketing departments, although it's extremely useful there. Its aim is to provide prompts for people looking to solve old problems in new ways, or indeed, new problems in old ways. And finally, I want to quote from page one, and I don't want you to tell the listener what I'm talking about, as you didn't when you wrote this. Let's not give it away, but I want to read this and ask the listener to think what this product might be and what company it is, and then we'll do the big reveal. So the book starts, In a secret laboratory hidden deep within Silicon Valley, a revolutionary idea is born. Nurtured by a small team of rock star scientists and shrouded in secrecy, it is an innovation with the potential to transform technology and human interaction with it. Decades ahead of its time, on 4 April 2012, when the project was first announced, it was heralded as such. Time magazine would go on to declare it product of the year, with everyone from celebrities and CEOs to presidents and global royalty wanting a piece of it. The Simpsons dedicated an entire episode to it, and Vogue even gave it a 12-page spread. It was an innovation that captured the imagination. This is a story about one of the most highly anticipated technology breakthroughs of all time. When first demonstrated publicly, it was revealed as courageously as the innovation itself, brought to life by skydivers jumping from a Zeppelin, rooftop bikers, and abseilers down to the side of the Moscone Exhibition Complex in San Francisco. No expense was spared. On 27 June, pre-orders were offered to a select few, and from spring 2013, it was made available to the public. But even then, not the open market. Enthusiastic shoppers were asked to pledge their case on Twitter to buy it at a $1,500 price tag, no less. 2 years later, it was made available to all. Then came the biggest announcement yet. As quickly as it arrived, it was going away. Sam Tatum, what was the product and what the hell went wrong?
That was, what a great introduction. Well, the product was Google Glass. That was such a, obviously, a hyped piece of technology, but fundamentally just brought in existing pieces of tech in and didn't cross the sort of the human chasm. I think I'm right that it sort of just the concern of live streaming one trip to the bathroom might be enough to cancel an entire product. And I use Google Glass as a bit of an introductory example into our appetite for revolutionary and radical innovation, and how sometimes this desire to create something the world has never seen means that we can forget some of the simple elements of human interaction and our evolved psychology. And that's a big part of the book. I mean, evolutionary ideas is obviously as a title directly countering revolutionary ideas.
Yes.
And why this sort of this appetite, this insatiable fight for radical can sometimes trip us up. But in actual fact, success of radical innovation is far rarer than we might think.
Yes. And again, I couldn't resist. This is one other thing I want to quote from page four. You say, when you first saw the cover of this book, you may be forgiven for having read it as revolutionary ideas. And you go on to write, our brains have a habit of seeing what they expect. And with our modern day culture's fetish for the radical and novel, we end up expecting little else. In life and business, our obsessions are a similar search for the radical and revolutionary. From weight loss miracles and viral campaigns to the launches of mega brands and the search for venture capital unicorns, we are hungry for novel and game-changing ideas. The field of marketing remains particularly obsessed with the big and the new. It's believed almost universally that radical and revolutionary innovation is what it takes to compete and win. Sam Tatum, though, what is the problem with that?
There's a few elements built up into this. I think one is around ego.
The more, right. The greater, what was I thinking?
The greater our status, the more we think we need to come up with big ideas. I mean, CEOs sort of talking about the twiddling on a checkout page feel like that's probably below their status. Whereas these are some of the elements that are actually sort of can be most critical to the success of an organization. So one is sort of big roles require big thinking. Another element is just a natural human optimism. This assumption that this time it will be different. Optimism, sort of an optimism bias, is a well documented element of our psychology, and it's really important that when the chips are down, that we have a sense of optimism to keep us hopeful and fighting for life. I mean, it's a great part of our adaptability. But when it comes to innovation, it can trip us up. This sort of assumption that where others have failed, we will succeed, is sort of ends us walking down a dangerous garden path. I mean, just look at Vegas, a city that's built on the spoils of gambling, and everyone sort of turns up thinking that this time it will be different. Right. But the final element, and I think the most important piece for me on this, is an element of proportionality. Again, in the realms of psychology, we can call this a proportionality bias or a proportionality heuristic. And that is that we have an assumption that big outcomes require big inputs.
Yes.
So if we're to look at the physical world, it sort of makes sense, right? If we hear a loud bang, we assume that it needed a loud input by which to make that sound. You drop a plate, it smashes. It's sort of a natural transference of energy. But in the psychological realm, it can be very different. Big outcomes can be achieved by small changes. We have this assumption that big problems need big ideas, but more importantly for evolutionary ideas, this assumption that novel problems also need novel ideas. Mm-hmm. And while much has been written about small changes creating big outcomes, what I sort of focus on in this book is that actually what might appear to be a novel problem that you're faced with isn't necessarily a challenge that hasn't already been solved before, even if it's in another category or industry. So the work that we do, and you picked up Rory's quote, it's a wonderful quote that's bolded in the book, evolution doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. I just think that's a wonderful encapsulation that we can find these evolved patterns of solutions and apply them to what might feel like novel challenges that we're faced with every day, but have actually been solved by others before us. And that's really the crux of the book.
Yes, there's a great quote from John Templeton, the British investor. Mm. The four most expensive words in the English language are this time it will be different. For all you folks in Vegas, all the listeners in Vegas probably work there. They know better than to go gambling. And it reminds me of once talking. We had this economic development client years ago, and he was the new director, and we came in with a number of ideas of what they needed to be doing to try to get the word out and promote what they were doing. And these were some concepts that had worked well with the client in the past, and it was sort of a things that worked well back in the ad day. And I remember this guy saying, but I've already seen these kind of ideas before. Yeah. I want something new. well, these ideas work well, but I just remember that. So I've brushed up against that. And one of the things that was made so clear in your book is about this whole idea of the solution might already be out there. And actually you said there's two classic myths of revolutionary innovation, which you mentioned. Big problems need big solutions, and new problems need, wait for it, new solutions. But speaking of revolutionary innovation, which you say is, I mean, it's one thing to say it's rarer than you might think. You go on to prove it. And speaking of revolutions, let's talk about the communists in Soviet Union. This is an unbelievable study they did about innovation. Can you talk about that?
That's right. A fascinating story sort of brought to life through a gentleman called Genrikh Altshuler, a Russian innovator that at a young age was sort of recognized by the Russian Navy in the Stalinist period and brought in to help really drive innovation for the Navy and worked from the patent office.
Really recognized by Stalin, right?
Well, that's right. That was the unfortunate moment. That I can absolutely, but before he had a mingle with Stalin. What he did was see patents come across his desk every day, and realize actually that many of the solutions that were being generated across the Navy were actually tackling very similar challenges and coming up with very similar solutions. Later, what he did with a group of colleagues, they assessed over 200,000 patents and categorized them into levels of inventiveness. Like what is actually sort of genuinely sort of net new innovation, and what is just the replication of an existing solution. And fundamentally, they found that about 1% of the innovations through these patents was genuine innovation. The rest was the adaptation of existing solutions. And so it's a fascinating sort of deconstruction. And while we sort of think the glass is half full from the optimistic perspective, when you do the numbers, the glass is the very sort of virtually empty. So Genrich went off to create a model called TRIZ, mm-hmm. where they can start to map these patterns of solutions. But before we get there, let's speak to Stalin, because that is a bit of a hiccup in his journey.
Well, and I have a feeling that at a lighter level, sometimes people, you know, make suggestions and they are penalized. But not right. the way this guy was.
This is
was.
Pretty tough. Well, what Altshuler did was send a letter to sort of recognizing this inefficiency within the Russian Navy. He sent a letter to Comrade Stalin, saying, "I've stumbled across a better way in which to innovate, and actually we're wasting time and effort with our current approach." And that was sort of received probably as well as you might expect. And he was quickly tried and sent off to labor camp for several years. So it didn't go down as well.
No, and I don't mean to laugh, but it was so predictable. But it's also, think about how much fear there is in the work world, and people are afraid to, if they're working for an environment where there's a lot of fear and, concern about it, where their new ideas are definitely not welcome.
Well, you're not always threatened with sleep deprivation torture, as Altshuler was.
No. But that's an idea, Sam. Maybe they could.
We could introduce this.
Right.
But what happened was at labor camp he was deprived of sleep and tortured, and he was sort of faced with this challenge, or the language of contradiction that he uses is, how can I sleep while stay awake? He was sort of kept awake during the all day and kept awake all night. How can I sleep while staying awake? And it sounds like an impossible contradiction. But what Altshuler did was, actually working with a fellow prisoner, he fashioned eyeballs out of a cigarette packet and charred pupils, and his prison cellmate sort of stuck them to the back of his closed eyelids. So as the guards walked past during the day, it looked like he was awake, but he was fundamentally sleeping. And solving this impossible contradiction of staying awake and sleeping at the same time is a big sort of trigger moment to his TRIZ methodology. And TRIZ is a Russian acronym for the theory of inventive problem solving. And that is, to innovate, we need to solve a contradiction. So just like we can stay awake and sleep at the same time, how do we make an umbrella that's big enough to cover the human body yet small enough to fit in a handbag? And that's a contradiction that innovation needs to solve. How can we create a bulletproof jacket that stops a bullet but is light enough for someone to possibly wear? That requires innovation. So this identification of contradictions is a really interesting part of sort of the innovation journey. And what Altshuler and the TRIZ methodology does is begins to marry up these patterns of solutions. As I said, is up to 95% of the innovations that we see in patents are sort of existing solutions, maybe just in other categories. Let's better match them up. And we're able to do that through the TRIZ methodology by focusing on these contradictions, like increasing the volume without changing the length, or increasing the strength without altering the weight. These are wonderful challenges that innovation needs to solve.
Right. And didn't he have like 40 rules that came out of all that analysis?
That's right. So they call this in TRIZ inventive principles.
That's right. Okay.
So if you think in biology, we sort of look at different species of animals based on their features. We can look at the presence of a spinal cord or gills, and we sort of categorize animals based on features. And in TRIZ, they do the same. So, for example, the inventive principle of segmentation. So sort of breaking a unit up into individual subunits. So if you think of converting a couch or a lounge into a modular sofa, that's using segmentation. Turning curtains into Venetian blinds, that's using segmentation. So from a lounge to a curtain, we're sort of applying the same inventive solution. There's one sort of, I think it's inventive principle number 7, called nested doll. So if you imagine the classic Russian sort of nested doll, a babushka doll, where you house different units inside of a large doll. And we see that across things like telescopic lenses, retractable tape measures, even nail polish that has the brush inside the bottle is an example of a nested doll. So through these 40 inventive principles, you can see hundreds of examples of these patterns of solutions, but we're able to simplify it into these 40. And it's these 40 inventive principles that actually begins to match up to help solve contradictions. If you're faced with the challenge of increasing length without changing the volume, then maybe it's a good place to start with nested doll. Like, let's start there first and borrow from existing ideas that are out there rather than starting with a blank sheet of paper.
Yes. TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flipped the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a free copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. Well, let's get back to Sam Tatum. I can't resist. Page 56, you've got another great story. And you write, several years ago, I worked on a classic retail challenge. Mm. Our client was running a quarterly promotion for one of its higher value items, and we were tasked with increasing the attractiveness of the offer and boosting sales. It could be said that our challenge was, how can we change the perceived value of the product without changing the price? And by the end of the promotion period, sales had risen by 56%. Sam, what kind of ninja mind trick did you do?
It's a lovely example. We just spoke about TRIZ and engineering solutions, so changing strength without changing weight. Now we're starting to look in the realm of sort of a psychological contradiction. So how can we increase perceived value without changing its price? And that's the sort of the important step off here. So we were faced with a client that had an annual campaign for a sales product. And oftentimes we receive these briefs, and it's sort of, how can we find a new way of speaking about the product, benefits of talking about the product itself? And what we did, just like a TRIZ methodology, is start to look at, well, what might be some patterns in psychology that we can pull into this, we can pull into our approach here. How can we use concepts like social norming to show that it's really popular, so that other people might buy it? How can we use elements like scarcity to show how limited the offer is, so people are encouraged to get on board a limited time offer? So just as we can look at inventive principles in engineering through TRIZ, we can look at these psychological inventive principles that the field of behavioral science is offering us. But the biggest step change for us was actually found in a concept known as quantity anchoring. So studies conducted in an Ohio supermarket found that actually with tins of Campbell's soup, when they had a 10-cent discount on the tins of soup, they sold an average of 3 units. But what they did was then put in a quantity anchor. So they said, but a maximum in one store, they had a maximum of 12 cans allowed to be sold per person. And when they put this quantity anchor, they sold an average of 7. So simply changing the quantity anchor, they were able to change the sales. And what we found for this offer, on every piece of advertising that we'd ever done, in the bottom left-hand corner of every ad in microscopic typeface, we had a maximum of 4 per customer. So we'd we'd fundamentally buried what could be the most motivating part of the offer.
Right.
So we tested a series of different messages and found that that was the most motivating, saying actually maximum of four per customer is the strongest signal of value.
Uh-huh.
If we were making too much profit, we could sell as many as we want. So it's just showing that there's an anchor on four, and that led to a 56% increase in sales, and we drilled down to an 87% increase in four unit transactions. So you're able to see very clearly the effect of that approach. And I love that as a systematic approach to solving a problem. We go, this is the contradiction, increasing the perceived value without changing the price. What are the inventive principles from psychology that we can draw upon? And how can we use those to start to build fresh value and new ideas? And it doesn't mean that every piece of advertising looks the same. We can have the same idea, but execute it with flamboyance and brilliance and in a way that's right for the brand. But we certainly don't need to start from scratch. And that was a key moment in certainly my career in embracing this kind of approach.
Yes. And you talk about the contradictions. I keep going back to Comrade Altshuler, who was sitting there with his eyes open while sleeping. Before we wrap up, I wanted to spend some time talking about the latter half of the book, if that's okay, the five most common psychological contradictions that are shared across business and innovation and behavior change. And I just want to ask you a few questions about each one, if we can. Let me give the listener a preview. And if these sound unbelievable, like sleeping with your eyes open, okay, that tingling means it's working. So the five are reinforcing trust without altering the truth, aiding decisions without limiting choice, triggering action without forcing a response, boosting loyalty without increasing rewards, and improving experiences without changing their duration. And those are, problems that I'm sure most of the listeners are struggling with or wrestling with pretty much, and they always will be. Let's go to reinforcing trust without altering the truth, which frankly sounds like a good idea. There's so many concepts you talk about in the book. I'm just going to pull out a few, but one of them is what you call signaling.
Mm.
So what can we learn about signaling from Van Halen and Brown M&Ms?
Wonderful. So signaling is a really fascinating area to explore all the way back into sort of biology, right? Many of your listeners will be familiar with the famed peacock,
yes.
Sort of the costly signaling of the long train that shows, or the tail, flamboyant, wasteful tail that signals to female counterparts that it's fit enough to waste its energy on such a handicap as this tail, that it must be a powerful signal of the fitness of the animal. So in situations of information asymmetry, which is how it might be sort of spoken to in academia, small signals like the flamboyance of a tail or a large signal in that sense, but an evident signal can speak to a sort of unknown fitness attributes. And when we look to trustworthiness, there are often times where we can't see what's happening behind closed doors. And that's where Van Halen come in. And it's a lovely example of an evolved solution. Again, I can't imagine Van Halen had behavioral scientists working with them at the time. But essentially,
they were motivated by something that went wrong.
That's right, and stumble across, and that's what's so. What I find so fascinating about this is through trial and error, and intuition, and learning. There's so much that can be learned from from a rock and roll band to apply to an investment bank. But Van Halen, every time they performed, they filled out a rider. So it's a bit of a contract for the promoters and the people setting up the stage and tuning the guitars, right? Everything down from the lighting to which guitar will be tuned with a drop D. And some of these challenges, for example, being thrown a new guitar midway through a show that's out of tune, right, can be catastrophic, but you don't necessarily know that until it's too late. So how can we have a more evident signal of the trustworthiness of the production team? So what they did in their rider or their contract is that they had a no brown M&Ms clause. So buried towards the end of the rider, they said, and when we arrive, we'd like a bowl of M&Ms with the brown M&Ms removed. So they knew immediately when they came on set into the green room or behind the scenes if there was no bowl of M&Ms or a bowl of M&Ms without with the brown M&Ms still in, that they needed to check everything again. So it became this sort of salient, visible signal of unknown attributes. And we see the same, and I speak in the, sort of a big passion of mine, and what I really enjoy and I hope comes through the book is then connecting this same concept with other things that we might be familiar with, like taking canaries down a coal mine. Mm-hmm. A practice that was sort of continued until the 1980s. And the fascinating thing about the canary is that it's evolved and adapted to fly at great heights over mountains. So it essentially double doses itself with the air around it. It can breathe in oxygen on the out breath. It's a really interesting element of the bird's physiology. And this is great when you're flying over a mountain, but it's terrible when you're stuck down a hole around it, surrounded by toxic gas, something that as a human you might not necessarily notice until it's too late. So just like a brown M&Ms was a powerful signal for Van Halen, when your canary keeled over in the bottom of the mine, right, that was a signal for you to know, well, actually, it's too dangerous for us to be in there. It becomes that clear evidence signal when other information is otherwise unattainable. So hopefully a few examples that stimulate our thoughts as to embedding some signals in our product, into our sales pitch, into our promotion that help to show accessible attributes of our product or service.
Yes, let's talk about another one that sounds like could have been coined by my dad referring to me, which would be labor illusion.
Yes. And
by appreciating and honestly deploying the power of the labor illusion, we can ensure that a product's engineered superiority can be more readily identified and trusted by those required. Explain that concept.
So the labor illusion is a wonderful concept coined by Michael Norton through work with Ryan Buell on operational transparency, a broader concept, and to speak to operational transparency first, as we seek efficiencies in business, we sort of can be driven to assume that we want to actually distance our customers from our interactivity. We have almost immediate payment when we go to an ATM. When we look on Google, we get a response within 0.02 of a second. It's instantaneously fast. But what this research is telling us that actually if we can start to show the transparency, the workings that are occurring behind the scenes to help bring this to life, we can boost perceptions of value and reinforce perceptions of trust. So just as Google, we might look at travel tips or particular flight options, and it gives us a response in 0.02 of a second. What the pair have found with a travel website like Kayak is you can actually boost value and perceptions of trust in the service by slowing this down, by saying, we're now checking the airlines on the eastern seaboard. We're now looking at these particular seat configurations. So we're able to actually tell the customer what we're doing to bring them the best offer. And while it might be technically slower, by providing this evidence of labor and this transparency into the system that's working behind us, then we can boost perceptions of value and trust. And we can see that from everything from the Domino's pizza tracker that tells you when your pizza is in the oven all the way through to when it's being delivered, just as we can watch a car from BMW being created and shipped from Munich to Los Angeles. And in this chapter, we explore many different examples that might seem more evident, like a Domino's pizza tracker, for example, but all the way through to subtle cues of transparency and labor. Great example from Monteith, the New Zealand brewing company, their claim, rather than being sort of delivered hot and fresh like Domino's pizza, their central claim was about being made from freshly pressed apples and pears. And how do you help convince that this is the truth? And what they did was they ran a campaign that had twigs from their orchard that they put in every box of cider. So people would open up the cider and see this twig and think, what's happening here? But it helps to just cue the production process. Just as Kayak is saying, I'm now checking all the flights on the Eastern Seaboard, this is an evidence, sort of a part of the production process that's buried in the product. And there's many of us will see this. Five Guys have Idaho potatoes at the front of the door. If you didn't have this sort of evidence that we make our fries fresh, that having a stack of potatoes at the door can really signal this transparency. I found the same thing in a pasta shop in Paris, where they stack the front door full of flour. Like, this isn't by accident. This is to help you believe the process of the, or believe the claim that's being made. So as we spoke to the contradiction, this is about reinforcing trust without changing the truth. Mm-hmm. What are the things that people can't see that they need to see to help us to believe our claim? It's a fascinating area of psychology, and one that hopefully once you sort of start to see, we'll see it everywhere.
Yeah. that's what happened to this reader. Yeah. I've started the elevators we're going to talk about in a minute, but yeah. So the second one was aiding decisions without limiting choice. So just so the listener understands, I'm pulling out like one question from each of these, which is really frustrating for Sam. So Sam, you're really holding up quite well.
Good.
So when you talk about aiding decisions without limiting choice, now I know that if you give people too many choices, they're less likely to make one. Mm. Is that right?
That's right. More likely to while we might think that more choice is better, and naturally we always gravitate to more is more. Actually, the more choices we have, the more likely we're able to defer. We're more likely to regret. Mm-hmm. We're more likely to delay a decision.
Yes. So many questions. Let me just pick one out. Talk about using concrete words and images, or some other kind of aid to simplify.
Yes.
A choice set.
Of course. So concreteness is really important for us. We find abstraction is cognitively difficult. And in the book, I sort of write about, we didn't evolve sort of writing sonnets. We evolved sort of drawing cave paintings. You mean providing these sort of more concrete elements of a story, and they're far more transferable across culture. So removing abstraction, and that can be the language that we use, where we're faster at processing a term like chair than a concept like immigration, right? We can visualize a chair. It has more sort of semantic connections than immigration. So saying build a wall can be a really cognitively efficient way of speaking about an immigration policy. So making language more concrete helps us to navigate these options. But I sort of take it a step further and look at sort of absolute concreteness and look at examples where we literally are closing the gap even further. For example, a concept in Japan called Sampuru, when you're looking at restaurants, and many people who have walked down the streets of Osaka might have sort of found these beautiful wax replicas of udon noodle soups and wonderful sundae ice creams. And what they do is they work to remove abstraction. I mean, when I'm looking through the menu, I can clearly see what I'm about to purchase, right? Because I can see it right in front of us. So it provides a real sort of concrete reference point. But one of my favorite examples from that chapter is actually a safety device. It's called the banana cone. So many of us will have walked around office blocks or airports and seen sort of slippery when wet signs with a yellow sign.
Which requires us to read the words.
Requires us to read the words. Requires us to better understand English. And I write about another concept in this chapter around airports, fascinating environments for behavioral science, because you can't rely on language. Mm-hmm. You can't rely on anyone knowing the spoken word. But for the banana cone, it's essentially a slippery when wet sign that's shaped like a banana peel. And while there are some
I've never seen one.
Have you not? They're wonderful. Albeit the brand has run the studies, but there have been studies on again, the speed of processing and recall of the signage. But again, it just uses everything. And I love it because it's just a smile. It creates a smile in the mind. I mean, it's salient and it helps to communicate. Mm-hmm. But rather than having a simple A-frame, have a banana peel that helps to sort of people see, okay, that's a slippery surface. And there are cultural associations around that. But there are other examples that I've just mentioned now in airports, where you can't rely on language. In Changi Airport, when they're encouraging commuters or travelers to recycle, rather than having signage to say this is for plastics, this is for cups, this is for paper, what they do is create big bins shaped like the recyclates. They have a bin that's shaped like a newspaper. They have a bin that's shaped like a plastic bottle. They have a bin that's shaped like a coffee cup. So it just helps people to, again, more concretely process what we're asking of people. There's no excuses now. You put a plastic bottle in a big newspaper, you've got bigger issues. but that's sort of taking the extreme of concreteness in decision-making. And as you say, it can go all the way down to just using more concrete language. If I can't draw it, I can't visualize it, I find it harder to process.
Yes, that's great. I had never seen these. They're all on the same page. It's great. Well, just one other question from this, just the second part that just I found interesting. And that is, in the business-to-business world, certainly buying is becoming more difficult. And there are more and more people on the committee to make the decision. And a lot of folks, there's a lot of risk. I would argue a B2B purchase is more emotional and frightening for people than buying the wrong car for their family. And I want to quote from page 154 and ask you to talk a little bit about this. It's about chunking information down. And you write, while we can chunk information down and break it into stages to make difficult decisions easier, this is a strategy that can also be deployed to reinforce the complexity of decisions at risk of appearing too easy. We can add friction.
Yeah.
Talk about that. And I'll be back in 45 minutes and see how you're doing.
I love that you've picked up this example, actually, because it's an area that I think is underutilized. So to speak to chunking, as you say, it's sort of breaking down information. We can make it easier for people to make an IKEA unit by creating it into steps. You know, something complex, we make it easy by chunking it one step at a time. But oftentimes we're faced with what might appear to be an easy decision, what could appear to be a deceptively binary decision, where there's actually far more complexity behind it. Or we want people to take more consideration before making it. And that can be, if we look in the physical realm, you can chunk up a train platform into designated places that are safe to stand or places where we say that avoid the gap. I mean, that's the same train platform. You've just chunked it up differently to help people consider it differently. But the example that I've sort of yet to shake as the most powerful here is looking at beyond reasonable doubt in court proceedings, where you might imagine John Smith off the street coming in to say, well, it's either innocent or guilty. It's a binary decision. Whereas actually what many legal firms do is help to break down the levels of proof that are required before creating a guilty verdict. I might just cut to it because it's interesting to read through I'll just open the chapter here. Really,
that's on page 156, the burden of proof thing.
Yeah. And when you look at, again, you might say sort of deceptively simple, innocent versus guilty, but you can break it down to, well, actually not guilty is proven not guilty, highly unlikely, less than likely, probably not, unlikely, possibly not, maybe not, perhaps suspected, possibly guilty, probably guilty, guilt likely, guilt highly likely, and then you get to guilty beyond reasonable doubt. So by breaking down not guilty into what is that, 12 stages, 9 stages, you help people really consider the burden of guilt. And it's the same, and I've spoken to some sort of medical friends of mine, and it's certainly not the primary reason for this, but if you look at sort of hypertension charts, and look at blood pressure, they break up normal into low normal and high normal. And again, this is just a manufactured line that we can say, well, you're high normal. So if you're in the normal realm, you might just be like, I'm normal, I'm cool, I'll go and have that burger and chips again. But by chunking normal down to high normal and low normal, you help people again consider their blood pressure in a slightly different way to if it was just all in one category. So we can create these chunks. That's the wonderful thing about it. We can help to create these chunks to help people people navigate a scenario, whether it's standing too close to an oncoming train or veering too likely to saying that someone is guilty when they've not surpassed the burden of proof. It's a really fascinating way in which we can chunk this down to help aid decisions.
Yes, and it came to mind the idea of educating your customers, helping them, which is what we really works extremely well. You build a lot of trust with folks if you're being impartial and saying, "Look, this is what you need to know." And I saw this, but basically teaching folks, of course, there's all kinds of benefits of saying, "Look, we're not a fit for every kind of customer. Here's the kind of company you need to find."
Yeah.
And then when I saw this burden of proof chart, I had to chuckle to myself, as I often do, Sam, because I've been on jury duty a number of times and I never get picked. So that was the chunking. The third one is the one that I found so really interesting, particularly for all those salespeople that listen to this podcast, triggering action without forcing a response. Now, you have a daughter, I believe, daughter, and I have kids, and I was once a kid, and talk about what reactance is. I wish more marketers and salespeople understood what reactance is.
It's a lovely area when we talk about triggering action without forcing a response. And reactance is really when our attitudinal freedom seems threatened. We have a tendency to react against it.
You're not the boss of me.
Exactly. Or I saw recently, I was watching, and now I have a second young daughter.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So I was cuddled up watching Mary Poppins again, and it's a shame that I didn't recognize this in the book, but there's that lovely song, "Don't Go to Sleep," in Mary Poppins, which is another great example of reactance. And I opened this chapter, I think I recall, with a classic dinner time routine, encouraging our eldest to eat her vegetables, and her requests of me to tell her to stop eating them, and she defiantly guzzles them down. "Don't eat your carrots," and she, "Oh, I'll show you, I'll eat my carrots."
We have the same daughter, but go ahead.
We can see this on the dinner table, but we also see this in things like the war against drugs, where actually, while you might think that drug use decreased, drug use spiked. After tragic events like Sandy Hook, you might think that gun sales decline. Actually, you find that with increased threats to ammunition and rifles, gun sales increase. So some unexpected outcomes when our attitudinal freedom seems to be threatened. So by telling people, as you said, you might not be a relevant customer for us because of AYZ, that could be the trigger to say, "Well, I'll show you. I'll show you that." Or withholding information from someone, creating sort of this itch, we can make it more intriguing. So I love another example is more colloquially termed the Streisand effect.
Oh yeah.
That they were taking images of the Malibu coastline to track erosion, and Barbara Streisand got wind of this, and she sort of took the coastal project to court to get them to remove her images of her Malibu palace. And I think before the point, it had been downloaded about six times, and including sort of twice or four times by her own lawyers. And as soon as she went legal on it, it was downloaded a million times.
Yeah.
So by trying to take things away from people, you can make it more attractive. But the flip side of this for listeners who are in sales or marketing, actually just reminding people that they're free not to accept.
Yes. But
you are free. It's a lovely sort of the "but you are free" effect has been found in several different contexts. Just remind people that they're free to decline can give them that sense of attitudinal freedom that helps them close the deal. So at the end of a checkout page, just reminding people, "But you don't have to accept this." Just makes it feel like, "Well, we're not being strong armed to this. If you're strong arming me on this, then I'll aim to react against you."
Yes.
Wonderful. Again, it's a juicy area of triggering action without forcing a response. You're not telling people to do anything. In fact, if one thing, you're telling them that maybe it's not right for you to help sort of trigger this itch.
I'll make the decisions here.
That's right. That's right.
You're right. Yeah.
I'll eat my carrots.
Yes, that's right. So There were a couple of great lines from page 184 and 85 that I want to mention. The "but you are free" effect is a successful means of increasing compliance in most contexts. By reinforcing personal freedom and empowering our audience, it seems we can trigger people into action. And then on the next page, you write, this is great for the salespeople, when it comes to closing a deal, initiating an ask or triggering an action, it can be as simple as reminding people that they actually don't have to do it that makes all the difference. Bravo. Well, let's go to the boosting loyalty without increasing rewards. So naturally, I think most companies say, well, you got to give more to get more loyalty. Not true, evidently. What are some of the ways that companies can actually boost loyalty without actually increasing the rewards or the value of the rewards?
Well, several, and as you say, there's a lot of research that's been conducted on traditional loyalty programs. So a lot of work by the Ehrenberg Bass Institute of South Australia. If some of your listeners might be familiar with How Brands Grow by Byron Sharp, looking at some of the challenges with loyalty programs, and it's obviously not universal. But there are, again, there are psychological inventive principles that we can use. And I write in the introduction of this chapter about the concept of sunk cost, whereas actually sort of the more invested or the more that we can show that someone is already invested in an outcome, the more we're likely to pursue that. So telling people how long they've been a customer, speaking to people about how much they've already invested with a brand, can just reinforce the fact that they are loyal or they need to be loyal because they've got this sunk cost. But one area that's sort of, I think, the first inventive principle that I explore in most detail is just about commitment devices.
Yes. I love it. Just get them to raise their hand.
Get them to raise their hand, to do something. You know, write something in with a pen rather than on a computer. Can help increase a sense of personal affiliation with a particular brand. But there's an example that's that I sort of gravitate towards in this chapter around sort of half now, half later. I mean, so giving someone something up front with the prospect of return in the future. So it's sort of, but it doesn't always need to be a meaningful part of the product. It can just be a cue of the service. And I'll give you sort of a couple of examples here, going from buying coffee all the way through to increasing vaccination in children. And the first is about that, looking at vaccinating children in India. And what we're all sort of by now too familiar with, the fact that vaccinations aren't always sort of a one-stop shop. We need to have several rounds to be sort of completely vaccinated. And one of the challenges faced in India at the time, and still in many countries across the world, is sort of incomplete vaccinations. Parents might take for one, but not come for a follow-up or not come at all. And I think it was actually JWT. I think it was JWT out of Mumbai. So your agency in Mumbai that did a wonderful campaign called Half Toys. And what they would do is they would give children half of a toy on their first vaccination. So give them half an elephant or something. And it was only redeemed when they came for the second vaccination. Just a nice way of thinking about sort of connecting the dots and providing a sense of commitment to follow through, and that's where there's, in fairness, it's a meaningful part of the product. It's half of a toy, but I recall in the same sort of solution, the same piece of innovation, a cafe I used to get coffee in Sydney. When the line was too long, what they would do is that the baristas would come out and they would just give people a coffee lid. They would come and sort of take the order and say, what will you have, a flat white or a latte? And they'd write a little L on the top of the cap. And so we'd have a whole queue of people standing there with a coffee lid. I mean, it's a sort of a useless part of the product, but by giving us this lid, they'd committed us to the transaction.
You had skin in the game.
Skin in the game. I mean, so it's a really crafty way of committing someone to an outcome. Even though every time I went to the front, I basically needed to order again. But by giving us an element of this, we'd committed people to following through. So other elements in looking at loyalty, we look at variable rewards. Many of us will be familiar with variability of a particular outcome be more valuable than a constant outcome. So again, rather than paying for every use, we can start to create some upside and even downside.
So now, is that example of that would be like at the coffee shop where they give out randomly a free coffee?
That's right. So Pret a Manger in the UK, rather than having a sort of a classic buy 10, get one free, they simply empowered their staff to give away a coffee a day or a certain quota of coffees based on their discretion. What they did find, that the sort of the funny side story to this one, is that there were sort of more attractive customers tended to get more free coffees from Pret.
Yes, I noticed that, Sam, and I have to interject, they were probably also Marketing Book podcast listeners, because Marketing Book podcast listeners are really good looking people.
Well, they must be. I mean, never received one. My partner, she keeps rocking up with several free coffees from Pret. I've never got one.
Yeah. Well, she's very attractive, and she's probably a Marketing Book podcast listener, but I digress.
She's doing better than me. No, but so looking at variable rewards, also through to a concept known as the goal gradient effect. So several examples of how that's come into life in academia and in sort of in the wild. So we can start to break down loyalty, just as we can look at aiding trust, looking at aiding decisions, triggering action. We can start to deconstruct loyalty in ways that don't always sort of require a greater sort of investment or incentive. There are some psychological levers that we should look to first.
Yes. So last one is improving experiences without changing their duration. And I guess most folks are thinking, no, we just need to be faster, like the trains you talked about with Rory. Yes. TED talk he did where they were trying to figure out how to make the trains faster from the UK to France, I believe it was.
That's right.
So they were trying to engineer something to make it like 40 minutes faster. And he said, look, if you just have fashion models walking around the train giving out champagne, people will actually want the train to go slower.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that Rory. You know, you just... What are you going to do with that guy? But I want to zero in on this one part that has to do with memory. This is really important, and we can talk about the peak end if you don't mind. But you're right that, and this came up in another book, From Impressed to Obsessed, all about customer experience by John Pico, which was on the show recently. You write, to truly understand how we might improve experiences without changing their duration, the last piece of our puzzle is understanding the role of memory.
Yeah.
Talk about the importance of memory on creating a great customer experience, let's say.
Absolutely. So if I can take it up a step, I think one of the biggest challenges with experience and improving experience without changing duration is confusing clock time and brain time.
Yes.
We assume that, and this is, I start the chapter looking at differences in perception of time across the animal kingdom, and what can help to sort of speed up or slow down time in humans, perceptions of time. And that can be around novelty, it can be about stress. The more stressed we are, time tends to slow down. The more comfortable and familiar that we are, time tends to speed up, and that helps us to understand. So there is a variability in perception of time.
Well, and just to add, Sam, when I read this part of the book, I now understand much better the expression "time stood still."
Yeah,
when somebody went through something very traumatic or exciting, they say, "Oh, time!" It's like time stood still.
Yeah, all your attentional resources are focused on the challenge at hand. Whereas when you're your brain can switch off, and when your brain can switch off, then time tends to speed up. Mm-hmm. But when we look at memory, and this is where Daniel Kahneman's research, and many of your listeners, I think hopefully all of your listeners will be familiar with the Nobel Prize winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman, looking at the difference between experience time and remembered time. So the time that we experience moment by moment, and the memory that we have of that experience that lasts forever. And what research is telling us that actually it's our memory of the experience that is more meaningful in driving future outcomes. So while we might be focused on moment by moment experience, actually what we should also be considering is what is the memory of that experience that's most important to leave with people, because that's what we take away.
Yes.
And Kahneman's shown this from everything from ice bucket challenges with people holding their hands in freezing cold water that starts to take us towards the peak end effect, all the way through to a beautiful analogy of listening to music. If you imagine listening to a record for 3 minutes and someone sort of screeches for the last 10 seconds and pretends they're a DJ, and people might say, well, you ruined the whole experience of that music. But actually, you listen to 2.5 minutes of beautiful orchestration glory. It's just someone ruined the end. They impacted your memory of the experience. So it's important to decouple this. And that's where we explore in this chapter.
And I'm going to do my best to make sure that this interview ends well so that people won't,
you know, we have a beautiful peak end.
think badly of you.
We start to think about what are the moments that shape memory, not just improve the average. You know, so just improve every living moment. Actually, you can start to think what are the elements that shape our memory of an outcome that stand out. And either that's a huge peak or the way an experience might end is certainly critical for memory.
Yeah, let me add to that. Page 252, you write, by recognizing the moments that matter most, peak end effect tells us that you really don't need to put a lot of weight on the duration or even the total average of an experience, just on how bad or good it was at its peak and whether it ended well.
And this is where, as a creative industry, we can start to what are the points that we can really bring our muscle. There's a lovely example from the book The Power of Moments by the Heath Brothers. Mm-hmm. Speak about the Magic Castle Hotel in Los Angeles. It's, I think, like high up the rankings on TripAdvisor, even though it's actually a fairly sort of rundown hotel. But what they do is they have a popsicle hotline. I mean, so when you're by the pool, there's a little red phone that you pick up and you can order free popsicles, and a waiter will come down with a popsicle on a silver platter, and it's just this moment that's sort of unforgettable, and so you invest in certain elements of an experience rather than improving the thread count and the linen. You know, that might have a marginal impact, creating these memorable moments. You've got the sort of the press for champagne button in Bob Ricard's Soho Hotel. Mm-hmm. You've got the ludicrous mode in Tesla. Every sports car has like a sports mode, but Tesla has ludicrous mode. You just have fun with elements rather than increasing the average of an experience. You create these peaks and, as you say, ensure that they end well. Yes. And that's where there's a whole chapter of looking at sort of or a whole element of the book looking at endings. And the quip at the beginning is, I mean, there are very few sort of notes about the first few nights aboard the Titanic that were amazing, right?
There we are again, laughing at the misfortune of others.
Didn't last the test of time. So how an experience ends, and again, this is sort of the moments that last, that shift it from our focus from the experiencing self to the remembering self, to look at the difference between brain time and clock time, we can start to invest our resources more effectively for the brain.
Yes, and it's interesting. You talk about the Magic Castle Hotel. I've heard of it. I'd never stayed there, but you write that it doesn't resemble anything close to a castle at all.
That's right.
It's really just an old converted apartment block with a small pool, lots of stairs, and no elevator. But they have that popsicle phone.
But it is magical.
Yeah,
it is magical.
Yeah,
it's no castle, but it's certainly magical, and I think we should. That's a marketers and product designers should salivate at these opportunities for distinctiveness, and not investing to take every element from a 6 to a 7, but finding a couple of tens that you can sprinkle throughout.
Yeah, and that, or at least start with those.
Totally, and that's where, again, as marketeers, this is how brands are built. Right. I mean, Tesla spends as much time focusing on how the doors open than how the batteries work. I mean, just because they're unique or dog mode, I think they have. I mean, just these fun elements that stand out in the mind, and that's what we need.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, Sam, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I think it firstly be understanding our insatiable appetite for the radical and the revolutionary. So understanding that we sort of naturally gravitate towards bringing sort of big ideas for big problems, and more importantly for evolutionary ideas, this gravity towards novel solutions for novel problems. So understanding why we have this pull, but also recognizing that radical and revolutionary innovation is far rarer than we might think. And actually there's a vast world of adapted solutions that we can now better see through the lens of behavioral science and systematically innovate to be far more effective and also creative in our outcomes. So that's sort of the key thing for me. There is space for radical innovation, but it's far less than we might think. And the evolutionary processes can be infinitely more powerful when applied mindfully.
Well, you made that very clear, at least to this reader. And I you know, I couldn't help but think there's a lot more wheel reinventing than I realized.
Yeah.
So what's one thing a listener could do today just to put in action one of the ideas from your book that we've talked about to get them, like handing that coffee lid to the people at the coffee shop?
Oh, I think the one thing that's inescapable is seeing these solutions around us. And I write in the conclusion, it can become a bit of an affliction. Once you have this new lens by which you see the world, it's near impossible not to walk around everywhere and see ideas latent in the environment. So I think bringing in out of category or out of context examples to help solve your problem, and whether that's borrowing from a pizza tracker or, as you say, learning from a cafe that gives you a cup lid to keep you invested in a line, there are solutions to many of our problems all around us every day, and now we have the ability to see them more readily.
Yes. Well, that's what's happened to me, Sam, and thanks, because now I'm even more irritating to the people around me pointing out all these tricks.
Every time I go on holiday, stop the car, I've got it.
Yeah. Well, pretty soon the girls are going to be asking your wife, what were you thinking? So looking back, what books have most inspired your work and career? I know you mentioned Daniel Kahneman. Thinking Fast and Slow is probably one of them.
That would be, and even Kahneman has updated elements of that book with respect to priming studies, and there are elements of Thinking Fast and Slow that have been discussed and disputed. But I think for me, certainly, it's a book that I remember coming into work early every morning with that book, just to have a sort of dedicated time to leaf through it and take copious notes. And that's certainly been a key text. And obviously a huge influence on our category. I think the work of Dan Ariely, captured in his books like Predictably Irrational, I think really valuable. Mm-hmm. And obviously we've spoken a lot about Rory, but I've been very fortunate to work in the same, firstly in the same organization as Rory, and then after several years work in the same office and consider him as sort of certainly a key mentor and friend. But Rory himself and his book Alchemy, a huge influence on this book and certainly my thinking and our organization's thinking for sure.
Well, let me tell you something there, Sam Tatum, employee of Ogilvy. If I were to ever have this question asked of me, and I won't because I'm not going to interview myself for this podcast because I haven't written a book, but what books have most inspired your working career? For me, it's two books, and one of them was Ogilvy on Advertising.
Yes, a wonderful.
I read it back in the 1980s after I came back from overseas, got out of the army, and read that book and said, that is what I want to do. And it's like you're talking about Thinking Fast and Slow, the right book at the right time in your life, maybe even more so looking back, can have an enormous impact.
You're right, actually. And I remember even earlier, Tipping Point. I remember sitting on a Mexican beach reading Tipping Point and Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. Those are two other books that have been influential in me moving from what is a sort of a classic career, I mean, that never exists, but in organizational psychology and moving into the creative field and marketing and advertising. Outliers and Tipping Point were also even earlier than the availability, I think, of things like Thinking Fast and Slow and certainly my awareness of even the field of behavioral economics. So if you've not read Tipping Point or Outliers, mm-hmm. and Blink, another great book,
right.
by Gladwell. He's a big influence on my very early career.
And he's got a new one out that I want to read about called The Bomber Mafia.
That's right. I've not read it myself either.
But he's one of those where you just go ahead and buy whatever they write.
Yeah.
Because you know it's good. Like the Heath Brothers.
Wonderful books.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Made to Stick. Made to Stick is another one. And there's elements of Made to Stick that have inspired elements of evolutionary ideas as well. So that's another great book.
Well, you were very generous by attributing a lot of your work to others and how you were inspired by their books. So
good.
Well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or maybe looking forward to reading?
I'm looking forward. So I've Richard Shotton. Some of your listeners might be familiar with Richard Shotton. Wrote The Choice Factory, a great book and sort of democratizing behavioral science and marketing. I think he's recently submitted his second book, so I'm looking forward to that. And he's a good friend and has been again another influence on the creation of evolutionary ideas as well. So I'm looking forward to that coming through.
And same publisher, I believe.
Same publisher. So Richard actually knew. I reached out to him several years ago about his journey, and he sort of helped pave the way with Harriman House, and has been a good sort of sounding board on what is when you're sort of working full time and have a busy family, like how do you manage to write a book, and what are the tricks and things to miss. So Richard's been certainly helpful there, and I'm looking forward to his second book.
Oh, good. Does it have a title yet?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, well, we'll be on the lookout for that. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, to your LinkedIn profile, to the Ogilvy site, either the Australian one or the Ogilvy London, where we can include both. It depends on where you are.
Ogilvy London is probably the best for now.
Okay, and your Twitter account.
Thank you.
A word to you, dear listener, please. I want to ask you a big favor. Please reach out in some way to Sam and congratulate him on this book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Send him a message on LinkedIn or Twitter or however you can get in touch with him. The guests on the show just love hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners who've listened to the interview. Some of them buy the books and start a conversation. They really,
absolutely.
Every week I hear from authors saying, how much they get a kick out of it. And if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book is Evolutionary Ideas, Unlocking Ancient Innovation to Solve Tomorrow's Challenges. The author is Sam Tatum. Sam, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
It's been my great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Douglas.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a free copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you're one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."